It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're coming up on 2 years since Pennsylvania first okayed medical marijuana, and the number of patients using it ballooned in 2019. According to the State Department of Health, the number of certified patients doubled this year alone, from 70,000 at the beginning of the year to 153,000 or so today. Joining us on the line is the State Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine. Dr. Levine, welcome back to the Confluence.
Well, thank you very much for having me speak today.
When medical marijuana first became available in our state, did you expect this level of demand?
So actually, we have expected this level of demand. We're very pleased that the program has been very successful, but it has not been a surprise to us.
So what's behind this, do you think, such a huge surge, especially in year two?
Well, so we have a very medically-based program for now 23 serious medical conditions. And over the last year, we continue to license and approve more grower processors to be able to produce the medicine, and more dispensaries to be able to dispense it as well. So as the program grows, we continue to have more and more patients seeking this very important medicine.
The state added anxiety to the list of approved conditions in July. Do you think that gave it a bump in the increased demand for medical marijuana?
Well, so that's one factor that led to an increase. And anxiety disorders is one of the more common conditions for which people seek medical marijuana. But it isn't the only reason. I think that the majority of patients seek medical marijuana for chronic pain. And that is consistent with what we would have expected from other states.
You mentioned 23 approved conditions overall. You said cancer, also glaucoma, Tourette's, MS, sickle cell, post-traumatic stress disorder, autism, epilepsy, etc. Are there plans to add more conditions?
Well, there is a procedure by which other conditions can be added. Patients and their doctors can petition the Medical Marijuana Advisory Board to consider a new condition. I then consider all of the evidence and make a decision.
Are you considering other conditions at this time, and which ones are under consideration?
So we have not received recently any requests from the public and physicians to consider new conditions. So it isn't that I consider a new condition and then make a decision. Someone has to petition the board.
Our guest on the Confluence is Pennsylvania Health Secretary Dr. Rachel Levine. Are you getting any early feedback from certifying physicians as to the effectiveness of medical marijuana, whether it's for the newly approved conditions or any of the 23 conditions?
So the feedback that we have from the physicians is that that medical marijuana is being used very effectively to treat the conditions for which they're being recommended. We also are very much looking forward to our Chapter 20 research programs. So under the Act, there are 8 academic research centers that will be participating in research, and we had a research summit this summer. And we'll have another research summit in March of 2020. And as that program gets up and running and becomes more mature, we're hoping for actual clinical research and data to support the use of medical marijuana for the conditions.
What questions do you hope they can answer, those 8 institutions, through their research?
Well, there are many questions. But for instance, you know, when we think of medical marijuana, it's not one medicine. It's not one compound. There are a number of different compounds at different ratios in medical marijuana. For instance, there is THC, but there's also a compound called CBD or cannabidiol. And the ratio of THC to CBD varies among the different products. And I think having more research about what would be the correct ratio for certain conditions will be very, very important. For instance, literature suggests that for the children with intractable seizures, that a very high CBD content is necessary. In addition, for patients with anxiety disorders, the research indicated that a high CBD content product would be most effective. But we need more research about the exact ratios, and the research coming from the academic clinical research centers will hopefully provide those type of answers.
Last we heard, the growers that are working with many of these eight schools are still awaiting approval from the state. That includes Pitts Grower, but they got a third chance to apply for approval in October. Any update on the status of that application?
Sure. The results of those applications should be available in the new year. I don't have a specific time, however.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin talking to Pennsylvania Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine. Usually new drugs take years of research and testing, then federal approval before going to market. Cannabis is still a Schedule I drug, so it's not going through that usual process. Are you at all concerned about that medical marijuana isn't being held to the same standard?
Well, it's impossible to hold it to the same standard because, as you said, it's a Schedule I substance by the DEA and the federal government. I would agree. I think it would be excellent for the federal government and the DEA to reschedule medical marijuana so that even more research can be done. But that demonstrates the importance and the value of our Chapter 20 research program and the academic clinical research centers, which will be producing very needed data and research and literature about medical marijuana, its effectiveness, and the type of detailed information that we were discussing previously.
In a sense, is your department getting its research through these 153,000 patients?
So the Department of Health is not performing the specific research. It'll be the academic clinical research centers that will be doing approved studies. These will all be approved by what is called their Institutional Review Boards, or IRB, which approved any research on individuals. And it'll be through the research programs of those excellent medical schools and osteopathic medical schools in Pennsylvania, which will demonstrate this data.
Would you be comfortable with this process, sort of certify first, research second for other medications, other treatment options?
I think that, again, the medical marijuana situation is unique because of how it's scheduled, and I believe incorrectly scheduled by the DEA. And so I think that the answer would be, and we would certainly call upon the DEA to reschedule it, but they have not at this time. So the advantage of our law is this research program, which I think will provide very important and needed research on medical marijuana and the details about the different compounds and the doses, et cetera, that will make it even more valuable.
I'm with Pennsylvania's Health Secretary, Dr. Rachel Levine. The number of certified patients has more than doubled this year. Is there still enough medication to go around?
So there are 25 programs that have been chosen, and there are, I believe, more than 10 at this point, programs that are actively growing. In fact, 19 are operational and 12 are actively shipping product at this time, and the remainder six are waiting there, you know, to be approved for operational status. While the program is still evolving, I know that there have been at times shortages, but things are improving. And as more grower processes come online and become operational and then actively ship product, then that pipeline of medicine will be even more robust.
So could there be a problem in the future if the list of growers doesn't grow to meet the demand?
When the program is completely mature, as you pointed out, it hasn't even been 2 years that the program has been up and running. We'll have 25 grower processors that are operational and are growing and actively selling product. And we'll have all of the clinical registrants working with the ACRCs that will also be. And I think that we will find that the supply will meet the demand.
Insurance companies are not covering the cost of the medication, following the lead of Medicaid and Medicare. What does this say to lower-income people who need the help but can't afford to pay $100, $200 a month out of their pocket? And as a doctor, as a care provider yourself, are you concerned that people who need the medication might not have access to it?
Well, we are always very concerned about the price. I think that you'll find that as the program becomes more mature, we have more grower processors, more dispensaries. As we have the academic program going, that the price will continue to come down. And then after we promulgate final regulations, we'll be able to institute our program to subsidize medical marijuana for indigent patients. But under the law, we have to promulgate our final regulations to be able to do that. And we are hopeful that that will be in sometime in 2020.
Dr. Rachel Levine is Pennsylvania's Secretary of Health. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much and have a wonderful day.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Cannabis is a unique drug considering how pharmacists interact with it. Coming up, we'll hear about how pharmacists are able to adjust dosage and recommend a different form of the drug, which is a unique authority often left to physicians. And there are legal challenges and nods from presidential candidates towards legalizing recreational marijuana, but how likely and how soon will we see that shift? Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
It's a special edition of The Confluence on the future of marijuana in Pennsylvania. I'm Kevin Gavin. State Health Secretary Dr. Rachel Levine says she'll consider adding more medical conditions to the state's approved list for medical cannabis, not because research supports their efficacy for pain management, but because more research is needed and opening it to the public makes the potential for widespread research more possible. That runs counter to the way that most drugs go to market, through clinical trial and FDA scrutiny. Dr. Ajay Wasan is a pain medicine specialist with UPMC. He spoke with The Confluence's Megan Harris.
How is that nuance affecting how medical marijuana is being rolled out in Pennsylvania?
So there's a lot of misconceptions. I think physicians themselves are very uneasy about the whole idea of prescribing versus dispensing. And it's an unusual process for a physician to basically make a recommendation and not actually be the one in charge of the actual conduct of the treatment, you know, like you typically prescribe a medication. And secondly, of course, it's very difficult for patients to understand that process, that there's a bit of a gray zone here and that the physician's role is somewhat limited. It's important and it's crucial. And I'm fully in favor of, you know, a medicalized medical marijuana approach to cannabis. But it does present a whole range of thorny things for patients and doctors to navigate through.
What do you look for when considering whether to certify a new patient for this treatment?
Yes. So a couple things. So first is we're looking for a real partnership with the patient and shared decision making. We are treating it like a medication in the sense that if we find someone is suitable to be certified, then we will make some recommendations for what we think would be better for them in terms of the type of medical marijuana they purchase. You know, there's all different things. There's sprays and there's oils and there's vaping.
And all with different kinds of chemical compounds in those ratios as well.
Yeah, and the big two compounds are the tetrahydrocannabinol, the THC, and the CBD, the cannabidiol.
THC being what we typically refer to as what creates a high.
Right. So it's the balance between those two, the THC and the CBD, that's important. And it's very unclear for many different conditions what that right balance is. And of course, it varies from patient to patient. So I was saying that the second part, the first part is this shared decision-making process and a partnership with the patient and our obligation as physicians to follow through with the patient, have them come back for follow-up, talk to them about what they have been purchased and tried and what the side effects are, just as we do with any medication, help them adjust sort of the quote-unquote dose. The third part is a patient who you feel will use the medicine, I call it a medicine, but use the substance responsibly. And you know, be willing to understand that at low doses, many of these compounds can be helpful, but there's a fine line between the lower dose that may give you some pain relief versus a higher dose, which may end up making you have all kinds of psychoactive effects. Yes, getting high is one of them, but then there's just feeling dizzy and groggy and out of it and confused. And there really is a fine line sometimes between the amount you take for pain versus some of these other side effects.
When building those relationships, how often do you have to see your patients? How does that work?
So the way we have it structured at UPMC, and we have a system-wide guideline on this issue, is that once we certify someone, we want to see them back after 1 month to see how they're doing. and then continue to follow them as needed to go over all of these different, you know, aspects of the marijuana dispensing.
As we just heard, Dr. Levine acknowledges that there are still lots of questions, unanswered questions about the right ratios, how it should be taken, timing, dosage, frequency. From your perspective, should we have known the answers to at least a few of those questions before the state approved medical marijuana as a treatment option?
I understand the rationale that Dr. Levine explained for why so many conditions have been approved by the state. But it's also tricky because for many of these conditions that have been approved, there is very weak evidence for it. So the complication is that inherently when a state says something is approved for use, it implies that there is sufficient evidence to justify that use. And that can't be said. So for instance, the National Academies of Medicine, you know, issued a very influential report in 2017 that concluded that there are only three conditions that would meet the standard for appropriate medical certification, so to speak. They didn't use that exact language, but that was a tone. And those three conditions were pain from a neuropathic origin, which means pain due to nerve injury, spasticity, and then nausea due to chemotherapy. Those three conditions, and that's it.
And at the moment, we have it approved for everything ranging from glaucoma to cancer to anxiety now.
Correct. And even in the case of anxiety, while I am familiar that there are some small studies showing it can be beneficial, there also is a substantial body of work showing that it can actually make anxiety and depression worse. And so it's a very difficult process. And as a result, the field of psychiatry, and I'm a psychiatrist as well as a pain specialist, tends to not be in favor of marijuana to treat depression or anxiety.
So in your mind, what are the inherent risks then of that strategy, kind of putting the approved condition cart before the research horse?
So I think, first of all, it's important for anyone out there to understand that there's a gray zone here. And the attempts by the state to navigate that gray zone and provide some direction and guidance are wonderful. I mean, I completely agree with Dr. Levine's comments that it's important that the state be involved, that there is a lot of potential public health benefit. But it's not really clear, even though there are all these improved conditions, it's not clear what really should be done. It really revolves an individual case-by-case discussion with a dedicated provider who's willing to sit down, take the time, sort through the issues, and give the advice whether it is appropriate or not appropriate.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. If you're just joining us, I'm Megan Harris, joined by pain medicine doctor Ajay Wasan. He's talking about medical cannabis certification in Pennsylvania. John Collins is the director of the Pennsylvania Office of Medical Marijuana. He told the state's advisory board at a meeting last month that 60% of the demand of medical marijuana now is coming from patients with pain or pain-related conditions, like the ones you see. Is that surprising?
Interesting. It's actually a little low compared to other states.
Yeah.
So in most of our states, it's 80 to 90% are the requests for pain.
Whether it's pain management or any of the other approved conditions, do you think that there is merit in the state strategy that this very restricted but open market on medical marijuana can precede research that might ultimately prove or disprove its effectiveness?
Yes. I think that's one of the key next steps is to get the whole research engine up and running. And so at University of Pittsburgh, we are looking forward to that as well. For instance, the first project at the University of Pittsburgh that will be conducted involves sickle cell disease and understanding the role of medical marijuana in treating sickle cell pain, and that is led by Dr. Greg Cato. For instance, there's also a huge need to understand the outcomes from medical marijuana, just the simple clinical outcomes of when a patient is certified for medical marijuana who has neuropathic pain, what is the rate of response? What's the probability that they will actually improve or not? And we have mechanisms and a registry at the University of Pittsburgh to be able to track and understand that exact issue. And that's also been the research that's been called for by the director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, Noor Volkow, who has said very clearly that one of the top priorities for marijuana research is to understand who responds and who doesn't for pain.
Are you at all fearful that even if it is effective in the short term, that there could be longer term unforeseen consequences to its use?
Absolutely. And we need to really keep a close tabs on that. So not to heighten fears, but the reality is this is a controlled substance for a reason. It may be useful in pain and other conditions, but there can be significant harms that I mentioned. And, you know, we're still in the middle of an opioid crisis. And if you think about the history of that crisis, there are a lot of unforeseen consequences that happen from the increased prescribing of opioids. Now, I'm not equating opioids with medical marijuana, but it's a cautionary tale that we need to take very seriously and proceed with caution. And obviously, the research approach is a key part of that. So the research is also part of a safety approach and understanding what helps people, what does not help people, and what are the risks involved. So that's the other way of thinking about it, is research isn't just pie in the sky type of let's go to the moon type of thing. It's also, well, let's study the possible risks, dangers, and harms simultaneously so that we can really avoid some of the consequences of the widespread opiate prescribing that occurred in the decade of the 2000s, the first decade of the 2000s.
Are you confident as we speak right now that medical marijuana is a effective treatment option for all 23 conditions approved by the state?
No.
Even pain medicine?
Only a specific pain condition that I mentioned, and that is for pain due to nerve injury. That's where the evidence is the strongest.
Do you feel good about your role in the system so far?
Yes. I really feel very good about helping my own patients as well as all the patients across the UPMC system to navigate this process. You know, one of the first things we did when the medical marijuana certification law went into effect was to create a system-wide guideline. And we were one of the very first healthcare systems in the entire nation to do that. And I think that has really helped thousands of patients really make the right choice and figure out if medical marijuana is appropriate for them and to use it responsibly, which also means you decrease the chances of significant side effects and harms and psychoactive effects in partnership with a good physician.
Dr. Ajay Wasan is the Vice Chair for Pain Medicine in the Department of Anesthesiology and Perioperative Medicine at UPMC, as well as a Professor of Anesthesiology, Perioperative Medicine, and Psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Dr. Wasan, thanks so much for making time.
Thank you.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pharmacists know a lot about how drugs work in the body, but they have no authority to change a patient's dosage or prescribe a different form of a drug, unless that drug is marijuana. As part of our series, 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed looks at how pharmacists are embracing the medical marijuana industry and making it safer in the process.
Marquita Wilburn is a true believer.
Cannabis got me through pharmacy school, honestly.
Wilburn is the pharmacy manager at Maitri Medicinals, a cannabis dispensary in East Liberty. When she went away to school in Virginia, she didn't know anybody. She was lonely, anxious, and stressed out.
It really did help me. It allowed me to focus. It allowed me to be present. It allowed me to get through it all.
From the beginning, Wilburn knew she wanted to be a cannabis pharmacist, even though the field barely existed when she graduated in 2011. Connecticut was the first state to require pharmacists in medical cannabis dispensaries when it passed its law back in 2012. In Pennsylvania, dispensaries must have either a pharmacist or a physician on staff. Locally, many dispensaries opt for pharmacists. Wilburn now helps patients figure out what type of cannabis is right for them based on their symptoms.
Do you want to alleviate pain, improve your sleep, reduce inflammation, improve your mood? And if you are marijuana naive, we kind of take it a little slower.
She also checks for interactions with any other drugs a patient might be taking. Certain pharmaceuticals can make cannabis less effective or cause it to build up in the body, and vice versa. That's the kind of information Jenna Vashevic needed when she started buying cannabis for her son Luke.
Luke is 16. He'll be 17 in March.
Luke has cerebral palsy, autism, and a seizure disorder.
He's generally pretty happy, except puberty has kind of thrown us for a loop, actually.
In addition to anti-anxiety and anti-seizure medications, he takes an alcohol-based form of cannabis called a tincture and a type of oil called an RSO. With the right drug regimen, Ivashevic says Luke is thriving. People underestimate children on the autism spectrum, she says, especially when they're nonverbal. But Luke is a speed reader. He's starting algebra, and he loves doing yoga.
All right, guys, take your bum, take your hips back to your heels.
Luke's got a huge smile on his face as he leans back into child's pose. Even though he loves yoga, Ivashevic says they missed a class last month when his puberty-induced meltdown started to get really bad. Whenever that happens, she calls the dispensary, and they help her figure out how to tweak his cannabis regimen.
That's why you need the pharmacist, because they know, and they will just tell you what they think you should try. And so we didn't know we had to add extra tincture in the morning until things just weren't really working out. And then we did it, and it's been working out better.
It can sometimes be tough for pharmacists to get the information they need to help patients. Most pharmacy schools still don't teach a whole lot about the drug, though the University of Pittsburgh School of Pharmacy is developing a course on it. And marijuana's federal Schedule I status makes large-scale studies next to impossible. But Melanie Kane, co-founder of the International Society of Cannabis Pharmacists, says she doesn't need more clinical evidence. She knows cannabis works.
I think it's one of the best drugs we have. It's not perfect, but it's one of those medicines that can treat so many different ailments: depression, anxiety, insomnia, pain, spasms. Now, you don't have this with other drugs.
What's needed, says Kane, is standardization of the types and forms of cannabis, education and certification of pharmacists, and destigmatization of the drug once and for all.
In my perfect world, it would be readily available in pharmacies, and patients would have access to healthcare professionals that are knowledgeable about the plants and about the body.
Kane says she'd like to see cannabis available to anyone behind the counter. That means people would have to consult with a pharmacist, but they wouldn't need a prescription from a doctor. People are using it anyway, she says. They're buying pot from dealers and CBD oil from gas stations. With pharmacists in the mix, people can be sure that their use is safe and effective, whether they're trying to relieve pain, reduce seizures, or just unwind after work. I'm Liz Reed, 90.5 WESA News.
Coming up, legal challenges to further expansion of the medical marijuana program in Pennsylvania, and what are the chances for legalizing recreational marijuana in the state? That's when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. During this special, we've heard from Pennsylvania's Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine, about the ongoing implementation of the state's medical marijuana program, and from Dr. Ajay Woosung, who certifies patients to purchase medical marijuana, but still has some concerns about how Pennsylvania uses medical cannabis. We're going to talk about further expansion of the program and what some see as the next step, legalization of recreational marijuana, with Mike Sampson, a partner with Reed Smith. He's the co-chair of the firm's cannabis law team. Welcome, Mike.
Good morning.
And on the line from Harrisburg is Paula Knudsen. She's editor with LNP and an investigative reporter for The Caucus, which covers state government and politics. Welcome back to the program, Paula.
Thanks for having me on.
Even though medical cannabis is legal at the state level, it is still illegal at the federal level. How do these opposing bodies of government interact on this issue? Mike, let's start with you.
Sure. There's a real tension between how cannabis marijuana is treated federally and how it's treated under state law. Federally, marijuana remains a Schedule I controlled substance, which basically means it is illegal for all purposes to possess, distribute, dispense, whereas in the states like Pennsylvania that have permitted medical marijuana or some of the states that allow for medical and recreational, it's legal. And as a result, there's a real tension between the two. And what we've seen is that the federal government seems to be taking largely a hands-off approach, and there have been few, if any, prosecutions, although much of what is going on still technically violates the Federal Controlled Substances Act or other statutes.
Paula, how would you assess that relationship?
Well, it's confusing, and I think that's one of the reasons why we hosted our event in Pittsburgh earlier this year, talking about all the different implications with federal law, state law, medical marijuana, CBD, the federal farming regulations related to hemp. I mean, it's just a very confusing area right now. And we appreciated folks like Mike coming on to talk about how other states are rolling out their medical marijuana programs and or their recreational marijuana programs, and how all these things kind of intertwine. And it really is an evolving area, as we learned from the guests who attended that seminar.
Even though medical cannabis is legal in Pennsylvania, on the ground, at the grassroots level, how is federal law impacting businesses such as dispensaries and patients, Mike?
I think for the most part, federal law, as mentioned, has taken a hands-off approach. Current federal attorney general, William Barr, doesn't seem inclined to prosecute. And so when it comes to the dispensaries and the like, I think that's been pretty business as usual, to the extent there isn't as usual. Where I think it has an effect are on some of the ancillary businesses and some of the businesses that think about interacting or doing business with the cannabis industry. they may be a little more leery, a little more hands-off because of the uncertainty when it comes to federal law.
And Paula, is it because it's a sort of a cash business, and also the issue that insurance does not cover medical cannabis for patients?
Right. We've heard a lot about concerns about the cash aspect of it, particularly as the medical marijuana regulations were rolling out in Pennsylvania. There were concerns about safety and security. How would cash be handled? How would it be held? And this is something that states all across the country have been grappling with in terms of trying to figure out how they store cash, how they transfer cash, how they can bank with it. And that's something that attorneys like Mike and his practice are helping clients, not only in Pennsylvania, but throughout the country, kind of figuring out the interplay and how that money can be handled and how insurance claims can be handled. And if there's someone who has a valid medical marijuana card and is working in a manufacturing facility where they're handling dangerous equipment, what does that mean? Does it mean that if they get randomly drug tested, they could be fired from the job? And also in Lebanon County here in central Pennsylvania, there's been other implications with folks who are on probation and have a valid medical marijuana card and are running into trouble with probation officers. So there's all kinds of unforeseen ways that these laws are kind of playing out.
Health Secretary Levine told the Confluence earlier in this program that the solution is for the feds to remove medical marijuana as a Schedule I drug. Is there any movement in Washington to do just that?
Yeah, there's any number of bills currently pending in the House and the Senate. What they look like varies widely, and whether, if and when they'll get passed is a whole other story. But there are bills, everything from what's called the States Act, which would essentially leave it up to the states and take a federal hands-off approach where the states have permitted it, all the way up to, for example, Cory Booker has introduced the Marijuana Justice Act that would decriminalize it. And basically everybody running for president in 2020, including Mr. Trump, have signaled their support for some aspect of one of these legislative pieces.
What about products like cannabidiol or CBD? They were removed as a Schedule I drug federally last year. It sort of unleashed a pretty much unregulated new market of products that you can find everywhere from grocery stores to your local corner convenience store. Do we expect any sort of regulations around the products to come up?
Yeah, this is an area that I think is rife with a lot of misunderstandings, because hemp or hemp-based CBD has essentially been descheduled as a controlled substance under federal law, but it doesn't mean that it can be put into everything. And so all you have to do is walk, you know, down the street in Squirrel Hill or anywhere else locally, and you can see in the window 37 different products that purport to include CBD. The problem is that while you can include it legally in topicals, creams, ointments, it still has not permitted for inclusion in supplements, food, drinks, and the FDA has not stepped in and issued regulations yet. They were holding hearings and public comments earlier this year, but right now many of those products are not approved under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and we'll need to see FDA regulations to see how they want to do it. At the same time, the FDA is also sending warning letters out to many companies that are making health representations about those products. So just because you see it in the storefront doesn't mean that it's necessarily entirely legal.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. I'm joined by Mike Sampson, partner with Reed Smith. And on the line from Harrisburg is Paula Knutson, investigative reporter for the Caucus, which covers state government politics. At the beginning of this month, Michigan became the 10th state to legalize recreational marijuana. Many would like to see Pennsylvania join that list. Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman conducted a listening tour to gauge public support for legalizing recreational marijuana. He reported that a majority of Pennsylvanians supported that. Has anything else come of this tour, Paula?
Well, it's interesting because we were in Pittsburgh in September, and Fetterman talked about his listening tour and how he had gone around the Commonwealth and heard from citizens with their feelings for or against legalization of marijuana. And shortly after that, the governor and Fetterman rolled out their proposal to legalize marijuana. But, you know, it hasn't gotten a lot of traction in the legislative session this fall, as there's been a lot of attention to things like minimum wage. There was a big criminal justice package that was passed out of the House on the 9th of December. So we haven't seen a lot, despite the fact that polling has shown that a majority of Pennsylvanians are in favor, and Fetterman's report that he issued also said that many citizens around the Commonwealth were interested in legalization. There hasn't been a ton of movement at the legislative level in Pennsylvania.
And I think that's consistent with what we've seen around the country. All the polling data coming out of national polls is now pro-legalization, and that's pretty true across all demographics, including, for the first time now, Republicans as well. And so I think there is a groundswell for something to happen. What that'll look like here or elsewhere remains to be seen.
All right. So there is and have been legislative proposals to either legalize recreational marijuana or even or less so decriminalize it. The governor and lieutenant governor, Paula, as you have said, have supported it. Legalization, as has the auditor general. But state House Republicans have said they have no interest in considering the idea. Paula, what's the objection?
Well, some of the objections from Republicans that we've reported on, particularly from House Republicans, they've said that legalizing the drug could create unintended problems in gun ownership, workman's comp, insurance law, banking, and other areas. And one of the leaders, Cutler, who's from Lancaster, had a quote to one of our reporters where he said, the issue needs to be addressed and potentially rescheduled at the federal level to ensure other issues are addressed in a constitutionally legal manner. So, you know, there's a lot of concern about what's happening at the federal level and how what we were talking about at the beginning of the program, how all these things kind of go together. There's also concern about impaired driving. And so it seems like there's a whole host of concerns from Republicans, ranging from what's happening on the federal level down to things like, you know, workers on their jobs or impaired driving.
Well, speaking of the federal level, it seems, Mike, that there's a shift towards prosecuting fewer cannabis-related crimes. Can we infer anything from that?
I'd be hesitant to infer anything from what goes on in the federal government today. But beyond that, I think clearly there is a movement at the federal government today to not prosecute cannabis-related acts that are consistent with state law. There had been a memorandum issued during the Obama administration that is often referred to as the Cole Memo that basically said there were limited prosecutorial resources available to the federal government. And because of that, so long as the states were regulating, the federal government was not going to prosecute cannabis-related acts that were consistent with state law unless it hit certain federal priorities. When Jeff Sessions became attorney general, he was well-known, is well-known as an anti-marijuana crusader. He rescinded that Cole memorandum and left it then to complete prosecutorial discretion. When William Barr was nominated for attorney general, during his confirmation hearings, he indicated that he would go back to relying on the Cole memo. And while it's not technically back in place, this current Department of Justice does not seem inclined to prosecute cannabis-related acts that are consistent with state law. There is also a budgetary restriction on the federal government's ability to use funds to prosecute acts that are consistent with state law as well.
So it's like we don't want to be bothered, or it actually costs money to prosecute these marijuana violations.
Yeah, if you look, and there's been a lot of discussion about some of the U.S. attorneys out in California, for example, that are responsible for some of the larger cities, they have a tremendous amount of issues that they're grappling with and limited resources. And so the question that the federal government has weighed in on has largely been, how do they want to deploy those resources? And so long as they have the comfort that the state governments are regulating it and acting consistent with their regulations, they're disinclined. And then, as I said, there's also been a federal budgetary provision that's been in place for a number of years. Often you hear it referred to as the Rohrabacher-Blumenauer Amendment. And what that amendment says is that there are no federal funds available to the Department of Justice to prosecute cannabis conduct medical cannabis conduct that is consistent with state law. It doesn't immunize it or legalize it. Right. It just takes away the ability to prosecute medical marijuana-related acts.
So, Paula, to summarize what you're hearing from at least a Republican leadership in Harrisburg, we'll wait for the feds to act. And at most, what Mike has said, the feds might say, let it up to the states. Is that a fair summary?
Well, I think, you know, some of the Republicans are not really interested necessarily in what the feds do. I mean, they have objections apart from what the federal government may or may not do, including, you know, some who are concerned that it's a gateway drug and the concept of drug driving that we talked about earlier, as well as employment consequences. So I think, yes, there's a sense that there needs to be guidance from the federal government, but also there's, you know, concerns expressed by Republicans that, you know, they're just worried about kind of quality of life issues overall.
So there have been city ordinances, and at least in Pittsburgh and in Philadelphia, that decriminalize certain amounts of marijuana. For those who support legalization, do you think this will work its way up from, shall we say, the municipal level to the feds or the other way around? Mike, let's start with you. Where do you think this is going? Is it going anywhere?
Look, I think we will see at the federal level legalization or decriminalization sometime soon. I don't want to say what soon is, but we'll stick with soon. The timing will depend, I think, in part on what happens in 2020 and what administration is in place after that. But the bottom line is the financial incentives are just too great to move back on.
Is it because of the revenues that would come into the government from?
Absolutely. If you look at, for example, Colorado just went over $1 billion in tax revenue. Pennsylvania, I believe, has already exceeded $1 million in tax revenue.
From the medical marijuana.
From the medical marijuana. We're not going backwards. I think we'll see legalization or at least decriminalization at the federal level sometime soon. I just don't want to offer the guess as to when soon is, but I think it's coming.
So, Paula, do you see action of any sort, and where might it come from? From the ground up or from top down, and what action might that be?
Well, as Mike was saying, you know, something probably is going to happen soon, and it looks like just based on a lot of the bipartisan support for criminal justice reform, that this issue of decriminalization really could get traction. As you mentioned, there are communities throughout the state that have already decriminalized. And that's a popular idea. And that may be somewhere where we see some movement maybe before full legalization.
Paula Knudsen is an investigative reporter for the Caucus and an editor with LNP. And Mike Sampson is a partner with Reed Smith and is the co-chair of the firm's cannabis law team. Thanks so much for making the time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, tens of thousands of Pennsylvanians will lose SNAP benefits, food stamps, if a plan changed by the Trump administration moves forward. Plus, we'll visit with the author of a book about the Association of Pittsburgh Priests, which has been an outspoken voice for major change within the Catholic Church, including married and women priests. If you missed anything from today's program, or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Julia Zenkovich. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.